This is Mark Strassman, a reporter with Unwired LA. We're about to talk to Todd Richmond, who was just recently appointed to the broadband executive panel set up by Mayor Hahn to investigate the future of broadband wireless in Los Angeles. Welcome to Unwired LA.
Thanks for having me.
Your institutional affiliation is with the Annenberg Center for Communication, not the Annenberg School for Communication. Could you distinguish between the two for our listeners so they won't get confused?
Sure. The Annenberg School for Communication is one of many schools at USC. Among the other ones are engineering, letters, arts and sciences, cinema, television. The Annenberg Center for Communication is an independent research unit which was founded in 1993 based on a $120 million gift from Walter Annenberg.
Who got it from everyone buying TV Guide every week, presumably.
Exactly.
Okay. Or Rupert Murdoch buying TV Guide from him.
Ambassador Annenberg had a variety of money streams, but
right.
TV Guide was definitely the big hit.
Okay. Now, are you the managing director there at the Annenberg Center?
Yes.
Okay. And what are your duties, essentially?
It's funny because I was describing in a blog post earlier today that I have a grease gun in one hand and a fire hose in the other. But actually, what the center does is we work at the intersection of technology and content.
Okay.
And what we're looking at are various forms of new media, how they affect society, how they affect education, how they can affect health. And as the managing director, my task is to look for the new areas, look for the people who are doing the bleeding edge work in those areas, and then look for interesting intersections to try and, we're especially interested in interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary research projects.
And what overall is the mission of the center? What's it trying to achieve?
What we're trying to do is better understand, how digital communication is changing the world around us.
Okay. And after you understand it, you're trying to communicate it to everybody?
Yes.
Okay. Now, how did you come to be appointed to this panel that the mayor set up?
I know Morley Winograd, who is the chair of the panel. He is a professor at the business school. He's also the head of the Center for Telecommunications Management. And he and I were two of the founding members of the USC Mobile Media Institute.
What's that?
That is a, it's an evolving species. It's kind of a rare bird in that this is a collaboration between six schools and six centers on campus,
right,
to try and bring people together from all sorts of disciplines to look at the broad problems that are posed by mobile media.
How long has it been in existence?
We've been working on it for about a year or so, and we now have 2.5 staff, and we're looking to, we've got some industry partnerships, and what we're trying to do, and we've actually had our first grant funded by a corporate sponsor, and I don't unfortunately have the details in front of me, but what's come out of it are a lot of interesting conversations and some grant proposals brought forth by people who normally wouldn't work together. For instance, sociologists and engineers.
Right, that's an unlikely combination. What's mobile media under the definition of that plan?
We cast a wide net. So we're basically anything that's mobile, that's untethered, so that is going to take any wireless. We look at cell phones, any sort of content that you can look at, that you can put on a cell phone, laptops, PDAs, your car. We're looking at one of the grant proposals that we've been looking at, actually between the engineers and the sociologists, are car-to-car peer-to-peer systems.
It might be useful to be able to talk to people in the cars right around you when you're stuck in traffic.
This is a really interesting project. This idea of what determines, you know, you listen to music in your home,
right?
But what determines your home? Your home is now your iPod.
Right.
Your home is your car.
Right.
To the extent that peer-to-peer, legal peer-to-peer,
right,
that distinction.
Such as there is.
There are some great legitimate uses for peer-to-peer technology, and we really like peer-to-peer from that standpoint.
Right.
But we're looking, you know, 10 years down the road, there's satellite radio now, but we're also looking at the possibility of, well, your cars are going to be mobile media centers, essentially.
Right.
And if you were looking for some particular song, it may be on somebody else's car stored in their media. So how do you negotiate communications between the cars to stream media between them?
Exactly. Or to set up a group discussion if you're at the 405 and 101 and you're looking for a good strategy, an exit strategy.
Exactly.
Okay. I think this was done a long time ago by truckers who would say there's a Smokey up ahead.
It's funny because...
In the age of 8-track.
CB radio was actually a harbinger of a lot of things that are going on today. If you look at weblogs and whatnot, a lot of that is... And a lot of the cell phone use is very reminiscent of CB radio.
It's just breaker-breaker, sort of.
Exactly. The only thing now is that you have unlimited range.
Right. And more bandwidth, so you can have multimedia versions.
Exactly. It's not just sound.
Okay. So you knew Morley Winograd. Morley Winograd, I assume, knew Mayor Hahn.
I assume so, yeah.
They're both big wigs in the Democratic Party of California, right?
That could be. I actually don't know their politics.
Oh, okay.
I've never met the mayor before.
Oh, okay. So, what was involved in your selection, and did you have to get approved by anybody? Did you have to divest yourself of anything? Have you met yet? What's happening administratively with the broadband executive panel?
We have not met as a group yet.
Right.
I was just notified that I was contacted by Morley and was asked to be on the panel.
So you haven't been inaugurated? You haven't gone down to City Hall to be sworn in or anything?
No, but I believe there's a press conference on Monday.
Okay.
So that may involve...
Day after tomorrow?
Yes.
Okay.
So that may involve some sort of blood oath or something.
All right. If you find out when it is, maybe I can go there and cover it. So.
Right. It's being anointed with oil or something.
Okay. And what's the... As you see it, not having met the mayor, not having met the... Before, or not having met your fellow... How many of your fellow panelists do you already know? A lot of them seem to be from USC.
The ones from USC I know, and the other ones I don't.
Okay.
So I think that's actually kind of an interesting mix, because it's good to have some touch points when you're working in a group like that, but it's also good to have wild cards.
There's no danger there'll be a USC click and a UCLA click and that you'll fight over it or something?
No, you know, the funny thing is my alma mater is actually Caltech, so I really don't have affiliations either way.
You can rise above the fray, be the mediator.
Or I can tunnel beneath it, depending on what technology is needed.
Or the metaphor at the time.
Yeah.
So what have you been told is going to be the mission of the, if I can call it the BEP or the BEP, going forward? What's your charge? What are you supposed to do?
Well, the way that I understand it, we're supposed to look out on the horizon and look at what sorts of technologies are out there for wireless, and what are the possibilities for implementation in Los Angeles, and then what are the possibilities, and then what are the implications?
Okay, possibilities and implications. It seemed to me, looking over the list of the people there, and I've talked so far to Rich Grimes, and I'm in line to talk. I'm trying to talk to all you members before as soon as possible. There seems to be a very good mix, apart from the UCLA and USC split, of people who are a little street smart and Ivy Tower a little bit, and also people in all the different. Areas that could be involved here, essentially the kind of interdisciplinary work you were talking about that you're involved with just at USC.
Right.
On a larger scale, bringing in people, kind of the all-star team or something.
Well, what we've found, and the reason that the Annenberg Center is really focused on interdisciplinary work, is that when you look at any of the problems today, there's no way that a single viewpoint is going to come to any sort of holistic solution.
Right.
I mean, you've got to, you could look at this wireless problem from solely a business model.
Right.
You can look at it from solely a technology model. You can look at it solely from a social model. If those are your single data points, you're going to likely have three different solutions that come out that serve different sets of population.
Right.
And the only way to come up with anything that makes any sense is to have them all in the room throwing things at each other.
Right. Now, I see that, and I think that's a great idea, and you get a lot of synergy that way. And the problem is, in almost any group that's brought together, whether it's a Senate House Conference Committee or any other group that's trying to reach consensus, is that there's the there once you have a common model of what the parameters are and what the dynamics are, mm-hmm. and then you can say, if we do this, we'll maximize the return on investment. If we do that, we'll maximize the delivery of medical service. If we do that, we'll have the most movies that are good.
Right.
And then somehow in there, and it sounds already that you're a pretty apolitical person, that issues of money and politics and power and authority are going to have to leverage themselves somehow to decide which factors are going to be given priority, or am I being too small-minded to look at it that way?
No. I don't think that you can get any group together, I'm apolitical as far as the city is concerned.
Right.
I'm fairly apolitical as far as USC is concerned, but I know the politics of the place deeply.
And by place you mean the city or the university?
No, the university.
Right.
I don't know the politics of the city intimately.
Right.
So in some ways that's good because I'm not tainted.
Right.
From that standpoint. But I understand political dynamics because believe me, there can be nothing more vicious than university politics. Especially,
right.
I was previously a professor at a small college.
Right.
And that's where it really gets ugly. Very little is at stake.
Right.
People get very nasty.
It's inversely proportional to the importance of what's going on.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, but here in LA.
The way I view it is, I'm thinking, and I may be wrong, but I'm going in thinking that we're going to come up with perhaps a palette of scenarios.
Right.
And that those will be put forth, and then the political types can start hammering on it and figuring out how they want to spin it or how they want to prioritize things.
Right. Who's going to get which money and which authority. What comes to mind here, although it's a pretty radically different situation, is the 9/11 Commission, which did its work with all those expert lawyers and so on and politicians, and then they said, here's Congress, you decide what you want to do.
Right, right.
And essentially you have that same as a panel, as a blue ribbon kind of panel like that to do that. What do you see as the if you were able to write down what the consensus was, do you know already what you think the priorities ought to be, or what you're going into it, what your preferences are going to be in terms of the allocation of resources and the prioritizing of different projects?
No, actually, I don't. And that's why I'm looking forward to this group, to the diversity in it,
right.
so that I can have somebody put forth an argument as to why, for instance, the medical sector should get higher priority than law enforcement with regards to this.
Well, is it really a question of one sector or another to get priority? Because it seems to me that wireless is really a contentless platform. Is that a naive point
that,
of view?
And not to say that you're naive, but there's an interesting intertwining between the content and the delivery.
How do you see that, and
this gets into a lot of the politics on the business side of things.
Right.
So let me give you a for instance.
Right.
If you're going to do Wi-Fi,
right.
there are a couple of different ways from a technological standpoint that you can accomplish that.
Right, which you generally characterize as what, two or three main approaches?
For instance, you can have a standard approach where you've got a very centralized approach.
Right.
Where you've got, you know, big iron, big carriers coming in, centralized control points and whatnot.
Right.
And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got a very decentralized, like ad hoc or mesh networks.
Right. In other words, a little bit the difference between the Bell system and the Internet.
Right, right. And those are, at this point, you can look at those from purely technical, from technical issues and say, okay, well, we can solve some things better this way and we can solve some things better this way.
Right.
But when you bring the companies in who are going to have to be players in this,
right.
they're going to have very strong feelings about one versus the other.
Right, dictated more by their business considerations and what their competitive advantages
are
than by the technical aesthetics of it.
Right, I mean, you don't have to look any further than VHS versus Betamax for the fact that in life, a lot of times, better technologies don't win.
Now, does that relate very directly to the difference between WiMAX and Wi-Fi, or is that not really coming up yet?
No, because those terms really, I don't see much difference between.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I I think that most people view those terms as almost interchangeable.
Really? Okay.
Even though they're not.
Well, they're all 802.
Yeah.
But still, I did an interview and some reporting on experiments in Georgia with a company called Alveron to create a countywide broadband platform,
mm-hmm.
which they did from three transceivers in the whole county. And they were reaching ranges of 30 miles.
Right, right.
And that's WiMAX. That's with WiMAX. Now,
right.
with Wi-Fi and a mesh system with broader ranges than are now possible at Starbucks, but still not citywide. Where's that going to come in?
I mean, part of this is if you look 5 or 10 years down the road,
right.
and you look at a true mesh network.
Right.
You're talking about the individual cell phones actually being the transceivers.
Really?
So that there are...
What's that going to do to the heads of the people who are holding them next to them?
What's more interesting, actually, is if you go that route, is how do you decide who gets to use the last bit of your battery?
Right.
Do you get to use it for your call, or does somebody get to use it as a jump
right.
to transmit their data? So right. there are all sorts of... And these are... That sort of a mesh network is many, many years off. But I think it's something that we have to think about because that's, frankly, what the engineers are thinking about.
It seems to me that a system for micropayments on that basis, and then you can program your node to say whether or not you want to use your last bit of battery power depending on what the marginal utility is for your call versus making a few extra microcents by transmitting someone else's signal.
Right, right. It starts
right?
to get very interesting
right.
if you take those alternative business models into those sorts of things.
Okay. What about in general, since we're just talking about it here, you've got thousands of variables changing all the time. I mean, you need a supercomputer or a grid computer to calculate the options here, don't you, already?
Well,
or is it simpler than that?
I think what we'll likely have to end up doing is boiling it down to, okay, these are some of the key factors that we need to worry, these are some of the key sectors that could be impacted.
Right.
So, for instance, what are the implications for the healthcare system? What are the implications for law enforcement? What are the implications for local business?
Right.
So we identify those areas. And then we identify a couple of different scenarios for the ways to do deployment and the ways to come up with business models to support that. And then you start moving the blocks around and seeing where things fall out.
Okay. Let me ask you to address a general question from a specific example and something you've already brought up, actually, peer-to-peer.
Mm-hmm.
Where either the elegance or the economic efficacy for the people using it ran right straight into the economic interests of the people producing content.
Oh, yeah. I'm cognizant of that every single day.
And I think that it's probably not just there either because, for example, I started working in the mid-90s to introduce remote internet voting into the political system.
Mm-hmm.
So far, we got one election in Geneva a few weeks ago that worked, and that's been about it for over 10 years.
Right, right.
And that's because in the beginning it was because the politicians didn't even know what the internet was. But once they found out what the internet was, and once I carefully explained to them how it would transform the political system if everyone could vote,
right? They didn't want to transform. Right,
they
right.
wanted it the way it is. And so, and as you see, this is 2000 was the year of the internet. This is the year. They're all the year of the internet. But essentially, they're still being used to raise money and put pictures out.
Right, exactly.
And not to rearrange the dynamic of the power structure of the political system.
Well, but what's happened is you've had a true emergence of soft power as a result of the internet. I think blogs changed the election.
Really?
I think if it had not been for blogs, Howard Dean would have never gone anywhere.
But in the end, where did he get?
Well, he crashed and burned because he yelled too loud.
Yeah, that's part of it. But the reason he yelled too loud was he lost that election.
Right.
That primary, so.
Well, but, I mean, things take time.
Right.
So.
But what I wanted to raise is the general proposition or question is, to what extent is it going to be possible to unleash the power of the internet multiplied by the power of wirelessness within a political, economic, cultural context that tends to not let not let too much of the status quo be changed until the time when it's been attenuated enough that it's not going to change things.
Right,
it's just going to solidify what's already there.
Right. Well, I don't know that we have to solve that problem.
Okay.
Because I think that we're at a point where cities are starting to look at Starbucks and say, we should be doing that.
Right.
So, and it's almost sort of a rushing blind towards that, saying we've got to be doing this.
Well, in fact, it's either a drought or a flood, because, and there's something I want to talk to with you about in more detail later on. Yesterday, SBC announced that it's going to spend $4 billion, not that this is the first time they've announced this, but that they're going to spend $4 billion to put fiber to the home, fiber to the node,
mm-hmm.
and just flood the California with bandwidth through their essentially immobile systems.
Right. Well, and Scenic has been working on Gigabit or Bus, their Gigabit or Bus project. And
right.
There's a whole lot of there's a huge push for fiber to the home.
And I don't want to say something like tulip futures or anything, but. 10 years ago, no one was doing it. Now, if SBC comes in and those people you just mentioned, and the city and Starbucks, the price of a bit's going to fall to the point through competition that it's not going to be able to support the companies that are providing it. And then where will we be? You see what I mean?
That seemed to have happened around 2000.
That's
right.
Right. That's right. But so, which isn't to say, you know, with the acceleration of history and so on, apart from the end of history,
then we'll see the same thing. We'll see these boom-bust cycles, I think, on a much more rapid...
Because, in fact, the fiber optic network that DWP has that's, I think, is going to be so important to this project, they built it, nobody came, several years ago. And now, maybe the time is right, and it will come in handy.
Right.
But even with all the expertise, and I haven't seen so much expertise in a particular area concentrated for in a while, you know, except when Thomas Jefferson, you know, dined alone at the White House. But I'm wondering if anyone is going to be in charge of seeing that those kind of things don't happen, or whether we got free market ideas and people and money and institutions, and it's just going to happen or not. It's going to be a very interesting process.
It is, and that's not. I'm not a sort of business and financial type.
Right.
So I'll be interested to hear what some of the other people have to say. I mean, I watched with interest and sort of, I wrote out from afar the dot-com boom and bust.
Right.
So there were some lessons learned, but it still amazes me that most people still don't get it. They still don't know there's a fundamental difference between an analog world and now a digital rendering and representation of it.
Right.
And that transition and that translation changes everything.
Yes, it does.
And there's a lot of people who are saying that, but they don't understand. They're just sort of mouthing the words.
There are a lot of people in favor of stem cell research and a lot of people against stem cell research who wouldn't know a stem cell if it bit them in the ankle.
Exactly.
And it's just the same on the hard technologies.
Right. And this is why I say I think there really is has been a shift in soft power, and that's a lot of that has been enabled by social software, which couldn't happen without the network.
So you're saying generally, with a democratic with a small d, that the profusion, that the deployment and profusion of these technologies is going to increase that even more?
I think so.
Okay.
One of the hopes that we have for digital technology is, okay, it's changing things.
Right.
But it has the possibility to completely transform education.
Yes.
And the way people learn.
Right.
And the amount that people can learn, the amount that people can retain
right.
and have access to.
And how much they have to remember themselves and how much data
search.
Acquisition, searching skills and critical thinking skills and analogy building skills, but not rote. I mean, this is
right.
way beyond rote learning anymore.
Right, right. And in the past, there have been a handful of people who have been trained
right.
in those types of critical thinking skills.
Right. A limited number of people.
Very limited. It's mostly scientists.
Right, okay, yes.
And I'm actually, my PhD is in chemistry, so that's why I say that.
Rigorous thinking, right.
Because I was trained that way.
Right.
I mean, we were, and it was funny because even as an undergrad, in my organic chemistry class, I was lucky to have a brilliant professor who said, forget memorization, you're gonna learn first principles and then you're gonna figure it out.
Right.
You're gonna figure out what's gonna happen.
Right.
So that, you know, digital technologies now enable us to do that because you can Google.
That's right.
You don't have to memorize all this stuff, but you need to be able to figure out how to bring disparate facts together and synthesize an argument.
That's right. Now, that ties in very well with the next point I wanted to raise. USC has however you want to measure it, is a in some sense, I haven't been there a lot in a long time, and so if I'm wrong, correct me. But the level of income and education at USC is, if you graphed it across there, it would be a big peak in the area that it's generally in. Would that be a fair assumption?
You mean of the students?
No, the community that surrounds it is what I mean. In other words, it's more densely full of money and learning and these critical thinking skills that you've just mentioned than the surrounding community. Or is that an incorrect?
Oh, you mean on campus?
The campus, as compared to outside of campus.
Well, yeah, but I think you can say that about pretty much any university.
Yes. Well, good point.
I mean, I'd say the same thing about UCLA.
You say the same thing about Harvard.
Yeah.
But having said it, the potential of this technology to spread, to diffuse the critical thinking skills and the access to the information, and therefore the wealth and the lifestyles beyond its own borders, is one of the crucial issues here, isn't it?
Yes. I think it is.
Because if you could, and so on the simplest level, do you think that it's as a result of all of this to-ing and fro-ing and planning and so on, in the end, that people in disadvantaged communities and individuals will be brought closer to the mean here in how much access to all this they have? It's a complicated way of putting it.
I would hope so.
Right.
And then let me offer a sidebar to that.
Okay.
So my hope is, yeah, that technology can make the lives, so everyone's lives better.
Right.
And that some of the ideas that we come up with can help erase what has traditionally been called the digital divide.
That's right.
We actually have a different definition of the digital divide, though.
Okay, what is it?
Our definition, what we call the digital divide, is those who know how to read and write on screens,
right,
and can read and write digitally, as opposed to those who can't. And it's not the ones that don't have. It's not about having the computers. We see plenty of people who have tons of computers, and they have no idea what screen language is about.
They're all dressed up with no place to go.
Exactly.
And they have a tool here that can bring in information from all over the world and send it out all over the world, and they don't have anything to say.
Right. And then alternatively, we have seen kids who are, quote, illiterate.
Right.
According to traditional school standards.
Right.
But they can make films.
Right.
That communicate to
but not,
people.
Right.
They understand spatial arguments on the screen.
Right.
They can play very complex video games.
Right.
Which require incredible reasoning skills.
Right.
And visual spatial skills.
Right.
So.
But the point. I mean, let me focus on that, because I've been big video games. Video games make more money than movies now, etc. I was watching a new video. Some ad for a new video game last night. It looked just like the scene I had seen an hour before in Fallujah,
mm-hmm.
with the helicopters and the walls and the soldiers and the explosions. It was like they had seen Fallujah today 2 years ago in the planning cycle, and they had put it into this video game. And I'm wondering, as it goes back, and the armed services use video games to train people to run tanks and
The Institute for Creative Technologies at USC is funded by the Army.
There you go. So I'm wondering whether what we're going to have here is people selected for their ability for these kind of spatial reasoning issues that you mentioned. But what's that going to be good for, except for invading towns without consideration of the political, socio-geographical, historical, religious significance of all that?
Well, I mean, one of the arguments that you could make is that the games Games is a huge topic.
Right.
It's a huge area at USC. We're putting together now an interdisciplinary games group.
Right.
Because we've got researchers at cinema television, we've got researchers in engineering, we've got researchers at the Annenberg School, we've got researchers at the Annenberg Center who look at the social networks that build up around games. We've got researchers looking at massively multiplayer online games.
Right.
So
That's sort of what the stock market is, isn't it? It's a massive multiplayer online game.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And if you look at MMOGs, what you see, it's you can draw interesting distinctions. I mean, that's why when you say games, it's such a broad stroke
that
you kind of have to break it down. They're the sort of action shooter games,
but
those also have cultural messages and biases built into them.
Well, yeah.
And those could be changed. But then the massively multiplayer games are all about cultures and now economics and political structures and whatnot.
Well, in fact, not to overdo the analogies here, what goes on in the business world with all this is, in some sense, a more refined and complicated and with higher barriers to entry of what video games are, with due diligences and stock options and lawyers and the whole thing. It's really a higher, more complicated level of that same process, isn't it? And the internet is neutral as to what's being transmitted.
Well, but I would actually argue that the massively multiplayer, that the MMOGs are actually more complex
than the business world and real estate deals and the legal system.
Yeah, because you have erased any sort of time or spatial barriers.
Right.
So you're doing all the same things, but you can do it whenever and wherever you want.
Well, let's remember that time is nature's way of keeping everything from happening at the same time, at once.
But in an MMOG, it can happen all at once.
Well, that'll be a pretty short game, wouldn't it? Or it's just a really intense one that goes on
Then another world pops up. I mean, that's the thing is that people are building synthetic reality.
Right.
But where it really starts to get interesting is that, for instance, Star Wars is there's a huge massively multi-online, an MMOG for Star Wars.
Okay.
And has tens or hundreds of thousands of players. And, Sony runs an online bulletin board system.
Right.
And so the players will get on that and they'll start communicating. And then what happens is that they'll start complaining about the way that certain people in the game are doing things to the programmers, and then the programmers start to make changes. So now, where does your synthetic reality start and stop here?
Well, speaking of where your synthetic reality starts and stops, I'm brought back to the classic of maybe it was the 80s or maybe it was the early 90s, a book called Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson. Stevenson, in which are you familiar with it?
No.
Well, everybody's gaming in this cyber reality, and since they put so much more energy into it, that's where relationships are forged. That's where economic relationships exist, and eventually, it sort of sucks the world into it.
Right. Right. Well, I have read stories about there are people who are married in real life, and then they're married to different people in the MMOG.
Right.
And they actually have met in real life.
Right.
And they're still able to differentiate between, I mean, the sociocultural research is just, I mean, this is all right.
And what we haven't even started talking about is, of course, there's a kind of this moving edge across, this moving wave of younger people who are born into a multimedia, unwired universe. They're born digital, right.
Yeah.
And the continuum of how digital people are is pretty much a function of their age, isn't it? I mean, there are exceptions. There are young people who, you know, like to read books, and there are older people who, you know, who game. But as a general proposition, I don't know, you check it out with the sociologists and the statisticians, but it's been my experience that the amount of, to oversimplify it into a digital continuum and an age continuum, you get a pretty close correlation.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's an inverse relationship. The younger you are, the more digital you are.
Right, right.
And so,
for instance, my 7-year-old son composes music using GarageBand.
Right. I don't know it.
GarageBand is an Apple program for taking loops, stringing loops together.
Right. Okay.
And then he burns CDs.
Right. And so
and that it's now second nature to him.
Okay, let's get, this is fascinating, and it's going to go on for years, and we're talking about, let's focus a little bit more on what's going to happen in here in L.A.
Right.
All this was prompted by the question, will poorer people have more access to this, and will the problem that's categorized as you can bring a person to a multimedia workstation, but you can't make him or her compute, is part of that problem too, it seems to me, because if you scatter, if we had, tomorrow we just put broadband everywhere in the air, everywhere in the whole city, some people aren't going to be interested.
Right.
And I don't know, is that going to be part of the charge of the panel, or is that going to be beyond their charge? Worry about
that. You know
that?
I don't know.
Okay.
It very well, I think the subject will come up.
Right.
And it may be that the majority says, you know what, we've got enough on our plate.
Right.
That we can't solve everything.
Okay.
So we'll see how that goes.
I want to focus on education a little bit. You're in an educational institution. We're talking about this. When I found out that this came to me because I was interviewing someone about the Brody Center in Van Nuys is getting air mesh to make it a hot zone.
Mm-hmm.
And after I talked to them, I talked to Tropos, who make the hardware to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the person at Tropos said, you know, the mayor appointed a commission to do this, to look into it. I didn't know that. Since I've been looking into it, thinking about it, interviewing different people, I thought, okay, let's focus on education for a minute. Let me call up the LAUSD and see who at LAUSD is doing some planning to figure out how to take advantage of this. And I laughed myself out of my own plan because, I mean, I could be wrong again, and you may have better information about this than I do, but this is not something that I think I could get an answer out of the LAUSD. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
Few members of the board, I've seen them on television, they look like they understand it. Maybe some of them should have been on the panel. Maybe they will. But I then said, okay, I'm not going to get an answer to this from LAUSD. Why don't I just start from scratch? Let's say we're taking as a given that we've got this broadband connectivity, wireless, everywhere in the city. Now, what are we going to do about education? Well, if you get all the people at USC and Stanford and UCLA and Harvard and MIT and Caltech and put them together and say, okay, now, why don't you develop a curriculum so that everyone can be brought up from where they are now, whether they're three years old or 83 or 93,
mm-hmm.
and given those critical thinking skills that you talked about,
mm-hmm.
shown how to access the system so they can get stuff, in a meta sense, be introduced to programs and both the video and computer that would educate them that way. That would sort of, there a few people's existing oxes would be pretty gored by that, wouldn't they?
Like the
entire LAUSD and all the universities, and
that they wouldn't be happy about that.
I don't know. Would they?
Well, the only thing I can speak from some experience,
right.
because one of our major projects is the Institute for Multimedia Literacy.
Okay.
And what IML does is try and teach people screen language.
Right.
That's where my sort of digital divide stuff comes out of, is the language
right.
from that project.
Digital literacy.
Right. Right. And they have, this year, they've just started now an honors program. So there is an honors program at USC.
Right.
In multimedia literacy.
For undergraduates?
For undergraduates.
To teach them to be multimedia literacy teachers, you're saying?
To teach them to be multimedia literate.
Oh, not to teach them to teach others to be multi. It's not like a teacher's. It's not
well,
a normal
no, there,
school
there,
in the Midwest.
There's another program, actually, that's joint with the education school, which is a master's in multimedia teaching.
Right.
Which is also starting up.
Okay.
So that teachers can go to the ed school, the School of Education.
Right.
And they can get a master's degree that focuses on integrating, on understanding multimedia.
Yeah, I'm trying to take this one or two steps beyond that. I can see you've got a teacher who's teaching history, and they say, here, read pages 1 to 6, and we'll talk about it, and we'll do a little role play.
The way IML started was, IML found a history professor and said, hey, why don't you come over, let us show you some things, and let's throw your syllabus out.
Right.
And that's what they did. And so they've now done over two, gone through a couple thousand students have run through the program.
Right.
50 or 60 classes and faculty in various disciplines doing that sort of thing. So that instead of, okay, you walk in, you're going to read, you know, pages so-and-so.
Right.
It's like, okay, well, there's the book, there's the web, you're going to have to build a project that's
funny you picked the Civil War. That's exactly where I was looking for my example right now. Your general, your picket, you're planning your charge. Figure it out.
Right. Right. And then say, okay, how about if you argue then come up with a concept for what would have happened if the South had won?
Yes.
What would New York City look like?
Right.
And tell your story through images and, you know, and whatnot.
Well, I'm optimistic, but I'm starting to worry because just as the analog book world threw up some people as more successful and others as less, it sounds to me like you're going to find a few people here who are really brilliant at this.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of people who are going to say, where's the escape key? And what do you do then?
Yeah, and that is an issue because, almost everybody takes piano lessons when they're a kid.
And not everybody goes to Carnegie Hall, even however much they practice.
Right. So there is an element to that.
Right.
But what we see is, especially with kids that are born digital,
yes,
they understand screens.
Yeah, okay.
And so they can at least read some aspects of things,
right,
and they can understand visual arguments to a certain extent.
Right.
So what we really want to do is try and expand that.
Okay.
So that they can have some sense of better reading visual arguments. So
right,
be able to look at an image and say, oh, I know why. Okay, look at that. Is sort of deconstruct an image,
right?
And then also then be able to put together their own. And we're going to acknowledge that people are going to be all over the map,
right?
But everybody's going to be better off for at least going through the process. It's kind of like, you know, your mom always said, "Look, you'll thank me at some point for making you practice piano."
Yeah, I don't know if everyone already always has thanked them.
Well, but a lot of them do.
Okay,
so.
Because on the subject, let's get back in a second to deconstructing images. But on the idea of one theme that seems to be running through this whole conversation is that the digital world is more complicated than the analog world, and that the variables in your commission, in wiring the city, in putting it to use, are all drawing in some really important issues and speeding up social change, but there are so many factors involved that, and they're so self-referential and undermining or facilitating, that we've got a simultaneous equation here with a lot more variables than even than Big Blue over at IBM is going to be able to calculate.
Right.
And I'm not exactly sure where that's going, because as a general principle, I've always believed the more technology, the better, the more opportunities for people, the more education, the more information, it's all good. But as a result of this very high-level discussion about all this, I'm not so sure anymore.
Well, and that's good, because
yeah,
people should be questioning whether or not the appropriate technology is being used for the appropriate thing.
All right. Maybe we're not going to figure it out. So that's
no.
Not right now. So moving on from underserved communities and whether this is going to solve their problems or not.
Okay.
Would you say that USC campuses are already as densely unwired as you would like LA to be? Is that sort of the model that you'll be looking to see about creating? How is wirelessness working out at USC?
Wireless is less than perfect at USC.
Yeah, from the technical point of view or from the social dynamic point of view?
Actually, from a lot of points of view. There have been some impediments. We're redoing our system.
Right.
USC actually was able to roll out wireless without spending very much money at all.
How was that?
Well, it's just, you know, working with vendors.
Oh, you got them to. You said we'll be a testing spot. Why don't you give us a bunch
of
stuff?
Yeah, I mean, however they negotiated it,
right,
or whatnot.
Okay.
So
you think the city of LA could do the same thing?
Well, it's possible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's where it starts to get. To get interesting is, and that's where you have to start to be a little bit sensitive to the business politics,
right?
Because it's going to cost money to do this,
right?
Or it's going to cost political capital to do this,
or you're going to have to give them the concession after they've given you the free sample.
Exactly, exactly. So I think that those, you know, whatever we talk about, that has to be running as a background process,
right?
I mean, we can't. I actually really like clean sheets of paper, and I like to come up with solutions that completely ignore, you know, any constraints.
Right.
and then come back down to reality.
Right.
And then say, okay, if that's the best case scenario, then let's look at some of the realities out here and start to tease out the things that we really can do.
Right. Well, do you think, given to doing a fast and dirty calculation of all the factors, either through giving away concessions to corporations or convincing them to make contributions in exchange for the expectation that they'll get something in the future, or using taxpayer money, or using volunteer labor to unwire the whole city to broadband capability by 2010?
It's ambitious.
Yeah.
I think anything is possible.
Okay.
I'm amazed that that pretty much every Starbucks has wireless.
And apparently they haven't gone out of business.
No.
But then again, they charge people for coming in and sitting there, and they charge people for the service too. Don't they?
I mean, T-Mobile does.
Right. T-Mobile.
Yeah.
Right. So they're not giving it away.
Right.
So within the context of a commercial enterprise.
But there's still
it's worked.
But it still happened.
Right.
And then I'm also, you know, stunned that there are certain airports that have wireless.
Right.
And that works. I'm also stunned by the fact that San Jose doesn't.
San Jose Airport.
Right.
In the heart of Silicon Valley.
Yeah, that it has, it's a service, and I can't remember, but it's a proprietary service,
right.
And it's only in 5 airports around the country. It's not
right.
a ubiquitous wireless
right.
solution.
Right.
So I'm simultaneously amazed by the possibilities and also the complete inability of things to get done. So,
this leads to a major question that I'm hoping the panel will address, and which I've been thinking about for a long time. Is what kind of economic models you think now, or you expect you'll think after the panel does its work, would work best? And those seem to me to range from letting the DWP, raise the capital, put it in, and charge people for it the way they do for water and electricity now, and make it a public utility, ranging from there on one side all the way to mesh networks where every person does their own thing that
right,
they want,
right.
and so on, and somewhere in between where the city as an entity through the DWP and their fiber optic network provides the platform, and then individual companies like AirMesh or their competitors can...
Right, some partner comes in and figures out their sub-model that's going to work
right,
on that.
Right, right. So essentially the backbone is built by the city, maintained and owned and sold on a bit by bit basis to
right.
them. And private companies can come in, and I've a wacky aspect here would be to let neighborhood councils run the concession in their neighborhoods
right.
as a way of
right.
raising money and getting people together and doing what they want.
Well,
so where along that spectrum do you think would be the best, or is that something that still has to be determined or to be experimented with?
I think that that's what's going to come out of the discussions. I think that we'll probably start with the two extremes and the somewhere in the middle,
right.
and it'll be people throwing stuff at each other to figure out which way to go.
Okay,
I think that you're bringing up the community aspect is a really important one,
right?
Because I happen to live in an area that has a very active community group,
right?
That is routinely suing companies around here for not, and is now suing the city for not doing proper transportation
right.
corridor due diligence and whatnot.
Right.
I think that this is the sort of next generation local politics.
Little deans.
Yeah, local activism
right.
is going to start to take place could take place in a more unwired environment. And the other thing that I think can come out of this is something that we've talked about is the fact that there really is no local news.
Yeah, you don't know. I know what's going on in Fallujah far better than I know what's going on in the other side of my apartment building.
Exactly, here. Exactly. And as you start to build out some of these infrastructures,
right.
and you start to put in, say that you've got community groups that are running the sort of local concession.
Right.
That they're going to have their own sort of little portal for that community.
Right.
and that may be then turned into a destination for the locals.
Well, I've thought of that, but what's going on in Fallujah is a lot more interesting than what's going on the other side of my building, and it has a bigger impact on my life, it seems. So things may already be at a kind of optimal level, or at least for the present.
I actually don't think so.
Yeah.
I think that people are going to become much more interested in what's going on locally around them when they discover how rich this place is.
Well, here's something that ties into that. I've long had a model here under which finally got a name, I think, after I was thinking about it, called telecommuting, in which, well, you know what telecommuting
right.
is. And in the extreme version of this model, nobody goes, you know, they turn the downtown towers into whatever they want to turn them into, and everybody stays home.
Right. My wife is an attorney, and she works at home 5 days a week.
And I'm a reporter, and I work at home, as you can see, 6 days a week. And I can deal with publicists and interviewees and so on pretty optimally
right.
from here. And to the extent that the work all becomes symbolic analysis or consumption of media, what's the need to flock into across the pass is there into Los Angeles and sit in traffic for 2 hours when you can be closer to your colleagues and coworkers all around the world and within the city electronically, which seems to me the big promise and possibility that this unwiring of LA would create. So under those circumstances, if everyone's staying home in the neighborhood, then I think what's happening in the neighborhood becomes more important
right.
than it is now, because you migrate out and you come back and so on, and you don't have any life in the community. But if people were home all day and they needed to go to little neighborhood restaurants to get out of the office instead of going to a few, you know, or a lot of high-priced restaurants downtown, then there'd be a fit between a different kind of lifestyle, a different kind of technology that would all work together, and then people could be simultaneously involved in their local community and involved in what's happening in all around the world.
Right.
Couldn't they?
Right.
So you know about that. Do you think that the panel is going to focus on that possibility and see about bringing it about?
I suspect that'll come up for discussion.
Right.
I mean, if for nothing else, that I would probably bring it up.
Okay. Right.
Just because I think the whole one of the things that we really focus on is the idea of community. And what's interesting is that some of our people have been studying online communities, and I participate in a number of online communities.
Right.
And I have friends all over the world just from one bulletin board that I frequent.
Right.
And there have been people, and I've met some of the people in person, and we've gone and, done stuff together.
Right.
And then there have been...
When you say gone and done things together, you mean you met in the same physical space?
Yes, we actually met each other in person.
Right.
But we knew each other, we knew each other's personalities, we knew each other's likes, dislikes.
Right.
For years previous, before
right.
we'd ever met in person.
Right.
There was another incident where one of the members of the bulletin board, it's Pelican Parts, it's for 9/11, mostly older 9/11, people who work on their own 9/11s and what, Porsche 9/11s.
Right.
There was an incident where one of the members was a firefighter and he died.
Right.
And it was posted on the board that he died and that he had bought this 1974 Porsche 911 to restore, and he died before he could do it.
Right.
And immediately on the board, people said, well, we're going to have to do something about that.
Right.
So I gave out my PayPal account.
Right.
And people started sending me money.
Right.
And the people who were local to where his widow and kids lived, which was back in Massachusetts.
Right.
The locals went up and assessed the situation and said, okay, we're going to need this, this, and this. And I collected over $5,000.
Right.
And these are all from physical strangers.
Right.
But members of an online community. But then what's interesting is then the locals back on the East Coast got together to actually start physically fixing the car.
Right.
So then the virtual migrated over into the local.
Right.
And then the local community gets together. And then, for instance, in Los Angeles, we routinely have get-togethers with the locals here, but all of our plans and our introductions and whatnot are made in the digital space.
Okay.
So...
this is online dating expanded to other areas.
Exactly, exactly. It's online communities, and they're all over the place.
Okay.
If you have any interest in any hobby, there are online communities, and they're all over the map as to how they behave.
Right.
And for instance, with the car world, if you look at some of the, ours is actually a fairly sane and fairly mature audience.
Right.
If you look at some of the sort of the import racer cars, those are, you know, it's the complete opposite.
Right.
And again, it's because of the demographic.
It's the Volvo people versus the Ferrari people.
Exactly. And they all have, but then even within a certain marquee, each board has a different,
right.
Within the Porsche, there are three or four Porsche boards and they all have a different sort of vibe.
Well, like they say,
and whatnot.
Three people, four congregations, you know, you got that.
So what I've seen is that we see these online communities build up, we see these MMOGs build up, and then we see them spill over into local spaces.
Right. Well, I think this is all consistent with what I was talking about out of the book Snow Crash by Neal Stephenson, that the energy focused into the cyber world then creates its own reality, which then expresses itself in the physical world. And there's a constant dialectic here.
Right.
And there's a constant balance in different places, in different areas, in politics, in business, in personal relationships, in Porsche aficionado clubs. The big question, and the last question here, will be whether you think that this event here, because it's one thing, it seems to me, to unwire Chaska, Minnesota, which has apparently happened.
Right.
Population, not very many.
Right.
And Los Angeles...
And not very heterogeneous, likely.
And not very heterogeneous. And Los Angeles is, you know, the most racially diverse, most ethnically diverse, most economic, most production of all these media. I mean, it's
right.
Pretty much a global node here.
Well,
and
yeah.
If we did this here, obviously it would have an impact beyond just here.
Right.
So my basic ongoing question here is whether or not, which I think was practically the first question I asked you, which is... This is a truly transformative technology. The question is whether what exists to be transformed will be more powerful in containing its transformative powers and channeling it into a heightened ability to do what it's already doing, or whether it will decentralize, destratify, and otherwise shake up the existing situation. I know how I may sound naive in some places, but I'm plenty cynical in others. And my bet, my answer to my own question is it's not going to change much, even though it'll change a lot. What do you think?
I don't know, but I'm a musician on the side.
Okay.
I've been gigging since 77,
right.
On and off.
Right.
So I follow the music industry fairly closely.
Right.
There are some people who look at P2P applications as a form of social and economic protest.
Right.
And
or a way to get music cheap also.
Well, yeah. But there are other people who say, look, there's more to it than that.
Oh, sure.
And that what you've seen is essentially a very closed society, a very monopolistic,
yes.
Brutal economic model,
right?
Pretty much brought to its knees.
You think so?
The recording industry is, there used to be 40 or 50 major labels.
Right.
We are now down to six.
Right. Well, there used to be 40 or 50 most things. There used to be 200 car manufacturers, and we're now down to three.
Right. But see, for the recording industry, we're back to the way it was in the 50s, before we had the boom.
Before we had the consolidation, you mean?
Well, yeah, but the consolidation is not only sort of the economic, not only, you know, the sort of telecom oligopoly-type model.
Right.
But it's also a fact that their business model has been totally destroyed, and that they're now in scrambling to try and figure out how they're going to monetize.
Okay.
Nothing.
Yes. Well, that's
how do you beat free?
Right. How do you beat free? Well, you pay people for it, but then you can't. What you lose on every one, you're not going to make up in volume.
Right.
So, well, that's exactly I think what I'm asking about, because what's happened to the music industry where you have. Is when you were talking about everyone being their own node and their own mesh element,
mm-hmm.
What happened in the music industry with blogs is happening in the journalism industry, and what happened with, you said, with with the Dean campaign is happening in politics, and in fact, and in business as well. In other words, the same. A brilliant person named Irwin William Thomas wrote a book, the title of which I've forgotten, but it was the one he wrote right, or maybe it was in Passages Around About Earth, and he said essentially in the past, in the primitive tribes, each person represented the church or the state or the business community, and then as society evolved, big institutions arose. But he said in the future, and he wrote this in the 70s, each person, because he said the technology is empowering individuals, he said, that each person will be able to become, have the facilities of these institutions. And that's exactly what seems to be happening. Because you don't have to be the New York Times or the Democratic Party to act like them.
Right.
Or music, or you don't have to be Decca Records to put out MP3s.
And I think that it's, I wouldn't go all the way to that extreme.
Yes.
Because of a point that we talked about earlier, which is, just because you took piano lessons doesn't mean you're going to be a musician.
Right. And just because
you've got to, right, you still have to be able to create some compelling content.
Right.
I think what's happening now is that the control over who gets to say what,
right,
is being removed from a lot of places in the world.
Okay.
And so that you now, if I'm a musician, and for instance, the last band that I was in, we recorded and produced and released an album without anybody having to touch it.
Right.
And people downloaded it, and we were on a compilation disc that was put out in Europe and
right.
whatnot, that was arranged through, again, another online community.
Right. And not just the distribution, but the production. You can have someone in Africa, someone in Uzbekistan, and someone in Studio City collaborating electronically with your son as the editor produce the stuff.
What's actually a funny story or an anecdote to come out of that was that this compilation album grew out of a Steely Dan fan online community.
Right.
It was a bulletin board that were all Steely Dan fans.
Right.
And they had put out, a lot of them were musicians, and so they started putting out these compilation discs and say, hey, if your band, send us some music, and then
right.
one guy would organize it and do it.
Right.
So in this last one that our band put one on,
right.
I got the disc, and I was listening to it, and here's this amazing song, but the lyrics are in Swedish.
Right.
And so I emailed Lars, who wrote the song, because I knew who wrote it.
Right.
And I emailed him and said, what's the translation? Do you have an English translation of these lyrics? Because I love this song. And he
right.
said, no, I don't. Do you want to write some lyrics?
Right.
So I wrote some lyrics.
Right.
And then my band learned the song, and
right.
we recorded our version with the English lyrics,
right.
and then put it up for other people to listen to.
Well, it's a world, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So let's. I'm glad we've raised all these issues. A lot of the point was to get them into the air here, so that you and the people on the panel and other people in the community can. Speaking of which, are you going to make? I didn't see much in the mayor's press release about community input into any of this. Do you have plans? Would you like to use all of these tools that we've already got and new ones that can be built to ascertain community input into all this? Because that could be.
I think that would be an interesting way to go.
Because from the way I read it, you're going to have the gurus are going to gather in the conference room and work it out, and then they'll announce it. The mayor will announce it as part of his reelection campaign.
Right.
Whereas instead, in fact, you could then build the community that you're talking about building by bringing them in on the takeoff as well as the landing.
Right, right.
That's
possible. The trick there
right.
is figuring out how to gain access
right.
to the people who are blogging and
right.
the BBSs who would be interested in this type of thing.
Well, you see, figuring out how to get input from 3.8 million people to determine how they would like to see their digital future be recalls in a book by John Barth called Chimera, in which the person uses a computer to analyze all of literature that's ever existed to come up with what the truth is the literature is trying to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes up by saying the key to the treasure is the treasure itself. And the point here is that figuring out how to get 3.8 million people to figure out how they would like to live under this kind of digital situation is in fact what you're trying to find out.
Right.
And if you can do it by doing what you're trying to do, you'll have done it.
Right.
If you see that. final point is this: our conversation now is going to go up on the Unwired LA website, and okay. and presumably millions of people around the world will be able to listen to it.
Well, I'm. hopefully, I was entertaining enough.
Well, you were entertaining and informative, and I hope we can continue this conversation over increasingly powerful media as time progresses.
That sounds great.
Thanks very much, and this will be up. Let me just turn this off, and then we can do some administrative business. But on the air here, thanks very much, and I think this is one of the most exciting things that's happened in Los Angeles since, I don't know, Sam, you already held a press conference. You know?
Which was a little while ago.
It was a while ago. Here we go.